If you added all the S&P 500 companies together.
Call the Human Service Committee, order, roll call.
I don't get that.
Michael Gable?
Here.
Rick Dodge?
Tucson.
David Hallman?
Present.
John Poole?
Here.
Andy Bird?
Oklahoma.
Greg Retzlaff?
Here.
Leah Blau?
Here.
Hannah Sorensen? Tyler McCarthy?
Any citizen comments? No? Come on. You can say something.
Well, I'm just very pleased that apparently there's going to be a little bit more cooperation between the city and the county moving forward, especially as far as the mental health facility. I think that's pretty good. And I've also, as an alderman, I've been working with Byron Wright, dealing with the, you know, at least the chronic homeless issue with First Step. We're trying to come up with a better solution than the situation we've got. So I think the atmosphere between the city government and the county government, I think, is going to improve and has been improving. And we're never all going to be entirely on the same page, but I think we're making strides in the right direction, and I hope you agree.
Sounds good. Approval of minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 A resolution to appoint Alderman Jan Makowski to the Kenosha Commission on Community and Action Board?
There's a mistake on the agenda, so you'll have to, I think, discuss and make an amendment. It should be an appointment to the Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency, and the agenda, I believe, had something about Commission on Aging. So
right.
Before we go further with his appointment, we just need to have you guys discuss and allow us to change, amend the agenda to address the appropriate committee that we'd like him on.
Do I have a motion to amend the agenda to put John on the right committee?
Sure.
Second.
Anybody object to putting John on the right committee?
I have. Mr. Chairman, I have no problem with that, except do we know what this is? I don't know.
Yes, the Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency. They, in our community, we contract them to provide the WIC program.
Okay.
We also have a health clinic that we operate out of their building over here on 63rd and 20th, is it? Yeah, mm-hmm. In that area. They do, in Racine, they also would do, they had a Head Start program. They did the energy assistance in Racine. We use UMOS in our area for that. But those type of programs and outreach. And they always want representatives from Racine and Kenosha to sit on their board. So that would be the position that Alderman Makowski would fill.
John?
I didn't know the protocol, so I wasn't good. Part of the reason I think that I was recommended for this committee is because WIC, the offices are on 63rd Street, right in my district, and so is some of the health facilities, etc. So this, a lot of the stuff that it serves in Kenosha is pretty much in the 3rd District, so I think that's pretty much why my name was thrown in there. Thank you.
Has anybody got any questions for Jan?
They have a community kitchen inside that building.
Yes, they do.
And I know there has been talk over the years of some sort of maybe Kenosha gardening program and whatever people grow going in there and being able to cook. I don't know if that's actually happened yet.
It has not happened yet, but there is talk, and I think that's a wonderful thing if it does.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and also Shalom Center, with the new one, is also talking about having commercial kitchens available for, you know, not just a soup kitchen, but for other things too. So I think, we have a number of community gardens that we're talking about. And some of these vegetables and produce are going to be processed in these kitchens and the food distributed, I'm sure. So this is a good thing.
Nothing would make me happier than to see you and Supervisor Berg on the front page of the Kenosha News holding a tomato.
That can be arranged.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Any other questions for Jan? I have a motion to approve his appointment.
Motion approved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Comprehensive Alcohol and Drug Treatment Program, Vivitrol.
So yeah, we put Vivitrol in parentheses because that would, I knew that would grab your attention and know what we were talking about versus this long name that I think Chris came up with here. But as you recall, this program was funded starting in January of 2016. We've had a lot of discussion prior to that and what it would do, and we have over a year of data now that we thought would be interested to you'd be interested in hearing about, so we're going to present that tonight. Chris Schoen from Professional Services Group is here, along with Amanda Tura from our Division of Health, Betsy Smith's over here on the side, and Dr. Gwen Berry Fries in the background, in case there's questions directly for them. This is a partnership. We have the money under the Division of Aging and Disability Services as part of our mental health and AODA approach to helping people. We use the Division of Health for the injection and a number of other things they do. It's not just giving a shot, and Amanda will talk about that. And Chris, through Professional Services Group, we've hired recovery specialists who are the ones that are really hands-on with these folks that are struggling with their addiction, plus the groups that are run and the assessment. So I'll turn it over to Chris. He does have to leave at 6:45. He's teaching a class over at Carthage that we're all welcome to join if we wanted to. But in the meantime, we got him for about 35 minutes. So Chris.
Okay, great. Thanks, John. You know, and I don't know how much you all know in terms of how we really kind of looked at this and set it up, but I can tell you we did a lot of research. And we looked at a particular study out of Los Angeles that looked at the use of Vivitrol and intensive treatment with clients. And we found that, at least certainly early on in treatment, it was a very effective drug to use in terms of treatment. We also actually visited Sauk County. Sauk County has a program that's similar, although not as intensive. They don't have the recovery specialist component that I'll talk a little bit about. And for the population of folks that we were really looking at targeting, we felt like we really needed those recovery specialists because many of these people have some pretty significant issues, not just alcohol and drug related, but mental health as well as many, many other things. So we wanted to build a program that was very integrated and intensive in nature because, again, of that high-risk population. So that's really what we did. So you'll hear about the components and the intensity level. Our target population, which some of you or many of you probably know, are opiate or alcohol addicted folks with a criminal history related to use. These are folks who really have an extensive criminal justice history. These folks aren't violent, but because of their drug use, they have several thefts, they have disorderly conducts, some of them have fraud charges, things like that. So we're really targeting those folks, and many have, 75%, you'll see in one of the slides, have a mental health history of some kind as well, okay? Many related to anxiety or depression. The referral process itself is very easy. It's a one-page referral. I wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to be able to refer folks into the program. The great thing about that is community agencies can refer, individuals can just call me on the phone and say, hey, I have a concern. In fact, right before I got here tonight, I had two messages waiting for me about concerned family members, one about her son who wants to refer him to the program. We get referrals from a variety of different sources. When we started the program, we started with the detention center folks. The reason that was is because of the drug itself, people need to be clean 7 to 10 days before we can inject the drug. And because if they're not, they can go into immediate withdrawals, which is pretty significant for them. So we really started with that population. We moved to, I guess what you call the community population, folks who are just kind of out there and really want the help. And we get a lot of our referrals from Kenosha Human Development Services, which has the IV drug program. We get quite a few referrals from that program. We also get a lot of referrals actually from the Department of Corrections. The probation and parole agents see this as a very viable treatment option where traditional treatment has failed for many of their people. So the intake and assessment process, our recovery specialists actually go in, they gather some basic information, a contract is signed that basically says they will follow all of our treatment recommendations, but they also understand the risks associated with Vivitrol. one of the things that the drug does, it really kind of blocks that high. So, you know, if people use while they're on Vivitrol, they risk overdose and death. So that's the first point when that's mentioned. And it's actually mentioned, so I'm looking at Gwen about four or five times prior to them even getting the injection, and there's documentation that they sign that they understand that. So again, the recovery specialists are key in that, but we also do a multidimensional assessment. So we're looking at mental health, alcohol and drug use. We're looking at family history. We're looking at legal history. We want to get a big picture of what this person's life is like. And I can tell you that a number of the people in our program had very normal lives before their addiction. Mm-hmm. One person I can think of right now was a vice president at a bank and made over $100,000 a year. Now has a significant addiction to heroin. So the other component, well, one of the other components is the treatment itself with the licensed therapist, which is individual therapy weekly, group therapy on a weekly basis. But the thing, the importance in terms of how we provide the service is the flexibility. Some people meet with a therapist more often because it's necessary, because they're not doing as well as we would expect. So we want to make sure that they, you know, they're focused on their recovery. In order to do that, we need to be flexible. We see people on Saturdays. We see people at night, whenever we can. So there's the intensive case management that I mentioned. We have two recovery specialists. Many of these people have burned so many bridges in their lives, you know, if they don't have a lot of support, they don't have someone they can reach out to. So for them, initially, it's really important to have someone who's connected to them and sees them four or five times a week and is able to help them with housing, with employment. One of the things that we do, for example, in the jail is we actually fill out the application for insurance with them. So the day they walk out the door, they are covered by, you know, most of the time Medicaid. And even for those people who are coming from the community, within the first week, we are filling out that application. And so up front, and you'll kind of see as we move forward, those first 90 days are so important. And those recovery specialists really help provide that support during those first 90 days, and certainly after, but particularly during that time. We also have psychiatry services. We need someone who can prescribe the Vivitrol. We have an MD who does that, knows Vivitrol very well, has been working in addictions for a number of years. And then we have health services, of course. And for me, this is a great public private partnership. We just have a wonderful relationship with health, and they really espouse what we do in terms of being kind of strength-based with clients, understanding where they're at, and really kind of helping them move forward and get better. So with that, I will turn it over to Amanda.
I'll just speak briefly on the Kenosha County Division of Health's role in this program. We receive our referral from PSG. And our assessment includes a brief synopsis of the program. Well, it's not so much brief. But we discuss how often they're going to see us, primarily every 28 days for the injection, and every couple months for their lab work. We go through a variety of paperwork, so their consents that they're going to sign. We're going to sign the authorization for disclosure of health info, giving us permission to give them their results. Their HIPAA, our HIPAA consent, our Privacy Act, and then our medical procedure consent. And this is going to be dependent on whether they're receiving the actual injection or they're getting lab work done. Our health history questionnaire, we do this at every appointment that they come to, whether it be the injection or lab work. And this just discusses their past history or current history of substance use. You know, we're primarily concerned if they've ever overdosed, if Narcan was utilized, in what setting was that utilized, were they taken, you know, by EMS or rescue personnel to the hospital? Was it utilized at home in a home setting by somebody else who could have or could not have been using? We're concerned about their social support, who they're going to lean on during their tough days, and then their plan for treatment. Are they prepared to partake in individual counseling and group counseling sessions at PSG? Do they have plans to go to Narcotics Anonymous or AA or seek other counseling services through different community agencies here in Kenosha County? Our initial lab work appointments, With these folks, we're really concerned about their liver enzymes or their liver function. So we're going to do a comprehensive metabolic panel and look at those enzymes and make sure it's safe for them to get the injection. And primarily, this is a concern with our individuals who have a past history of IV drug use who potentially could be hepatitis C positive. Our CBC is a complete blood count. We're looking at their red and white blood cells to make sure, you know, that they don't have an underlying infection, that they're not bleeding out. And because they're a high-risk population and because most of them do have a past history of IV drug use, we're doing some STD testing, so some HIV testing, Hep B and C's, syphilis, and we're sending their urine on for chlamydia and gonorrhea. With our new DA clients, we're also doing a TB skin test placement just to rule out TB, or communicable disease. Once we do all of this, the review of the MDA, or the multidimensional assessment that Chris spoke about, is reviewed by our nurse practitioners, either Betsy or Gwen Perry Bry, and they also review the labs to make sure that it's safe to give them the injection. With our KCDC clients, these clients are released directly from the detention center and come to us to receive their injection. And then with the community clients, dependent on their last reported date of usage, or whether they provided a urine and it was positive for opiates, we schedule their injection 7 to 10 days out from that time. In the meantime, if they do disclose any substance use, you know, we have clear communication with PSG, with the recovery specialist, you know, they use, we need to push out their injection appointment, and we're always very flexible with that. And then with the telepsychiatry appointment that Chris spoke about, the telepsychiatrist, Dr. Rosenberg, reviews their labs and makes sure it's safe to give them the injection and does the prescribing, as well as Gwen and Alyssa and Betsy. Sorry. The injection appointment kind of looks like this. The client will present to clinic or not at their scheduled date and time. Upon presentation, a urine is provided, and we do a 12-panel and ETOH screen on that urine. If they're female, we do a pregnancy test. Vivitrol is contraindicated in pregnancy, so we, you know, we're not going to give that Vivitrol injection if they're pregnant. And we have had a couple clients that have become pregnant throughout their treatment. The naltrexone challenge is initiated, and the naltrexone challenge is a 25 milligram tablet, and we're going to give this as a safe check for not only ourselves but for the client themselves. So if a client comes into us for an injection appointment but they use in the parking lot, that may not be detected in their urine through the 12-panel screen. So we do that naltrexone challenge because if they had used, they're going to go into immediate withdrawal. Rescue's called, and then we wouldn't go on with the injection appointment. All of our clients have been extremely honest with us because nobody wants to go into withdrawal. So we haven't had that happen yet. Let's hope that it doesn't happen. The health history questionnaire is completed, and this is the substance use, the past history of substance use questionnaire that I discussed with you earlier. Our MAT, or our medication assisted treatment consent, is reviewed and signed by the client. And this is just a 6-page document, a basic overview of what the injection is, what Vivitrol is, the indications or reasons we would give it, reasons we wouldn't give it, some warnings or precautions, and some adverse reactions or some side effects that they may experience while on the medication. At the first injection appointment, they receive a brochure of Vivitrol, which basically is the MAT consent. They receive an emergency pain management card, an appointment card, a bracelet, and a dog tag. And really the importance of this is if they're in an emergency situation, like a car accident, they required emergency surgery, because they're on Vivitrol, an opioid pain medication is not going to work. So we need something that identifies that they're on Vivitrol, so EMS personnel, the surgeon, the ER physician knows to give them a different pain relief medication. Follow-up appointment is scheduled at an injection appointment or a lab work appointment. Lab work is completed, and this has changed with the change of the new telepsychiatrist. Lab work is completed actually the first month, third month, sixth month, and then if they continue after 6 months, the ninth and 12th month, and their injection is scheduled every 28 days.
Amanda, how long is that injection appointment?
Typically, it's an hour and a half with the first injection. Subsequent injection or future injections typically last an hour. Lab appointments generally are an hour, dependent on the extensity of vein damage. If they've been using IV drugs for a while, it may take a little longer.
Is this just a shot, or do you?
It is. Well, it's a big shot. it's an inject. It's Naltrex or Vivitrol. It's injectable naltrexone. So we utilize a 2-inch needle, and it goes into the upper outer quadrant of the right or left buttock, dependent on what injection they're at.
Medicaid doesn't cover it, does it?
It does. Medicaid actually
does
cover it.
Yes, it does.
Is that been recent?
That's been since we started. That's why we enroll them before they get out of the detention center, so when they come out, they're covered by Medicaid.
Oh, I'm thinking, what am I thinking? When we went through the expensive...
That was the bump for Narcan?
Narcan, okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'm sorry. You're right.
Yeah, it's a monthly shot, so they only go in once a month for the shot.
Okay.
Are most of them coming back clean, or...
Yeah, Chris is going to get into some statistics, but the majority of them are coming back opiate-free. Mm-hmm. They may partake in other substance use, and you know, that's certainly a treatment issue, and we refer them back to PSG if that happens with us. But the majority of our clients are not using opiates.
Actually, less than 5% of those UAs are coming back with opiates or alcohol in them. So, and our clients will try other substances. Mm-hmm. Part of that is they've used drugs and alcohol for so long as a coping mechanism that it's difficult for them, particularly initially, to kind of just say, okay, I'm going to throw that out and I'm going to stay clean. And you know, for us, it's trying to put something, you know, a wise person once told me, you know, you can't take something away without putting something back in its place. And so for us, it's trying to get these people some coping mechanisms, so you know, the drugs and alcohol, you know, aren't the ones they go to.
So what if it was PSG, what's that stand for?
Professional Services Group.
That part of the county administration?
No, we're actually a contracted agency.
Yeah, we're a private run agency.
Some common side effects of Vivitrol. Really the biggest three, I would say, are nausea. This typically happens with the first injection appointment. With future subsequent injections, this is less likely. A lot of our clients complain of fatigue or lethargy, and that's, you know, it's a common side effect that's normal. Headache, we've had a few clients complain of headache, but you know, this medication, I don't want to say is a miracle drug by any means, but you know, it significantly reduces their cravings for opiates with very little or minimal side effects. So some other side effects listed there: dizziness, decreased appetite, painful joints, muscle cramps, cold symptoms, troubles, and pain, toothache. I know I said very minimal, but no, our clients don't really complain
like
of those. I said it really fast too, right? I just want to mention the severe side effects. Just one particularly is depression. Our clients, you know, after they receive the injection, they may go through a week or so feeling depressed or down in the dumps, and we certainly educate on any, you know, suicidal ideations. They have a plan, or they're having thoughts, to certainly notify people closest to them, PSG, of course, and then us.
And one of the things I wanted to mention about the medication, you know, one of the difficult parts about getting to those coping mechanisms and really helping people focus are those cravings are so extreme for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And prior to probably the last decade or so, we didn't have a lot of options from a medication perspective. And the Vivitrol just helps calm the cravings down so we can really kind of focus on what's going on in their lives and what brought them to their addiction. So it's extremely helpful in that way. So just to give you some basic program data, as I'm sure you're all well aware, there's a significant need. From January of last year, we actually started more about February 1st of last year to February 28th of this year, we've gotten 163 referrals, so quite a large number, and they can continue to come in. In fact, I can tell you in November and December, I think I received over 30 in those 2 months alone, so a pretty significant numbers. We provided service to 101 of those clients. Some clients don't get back to us. Someone says, hey, I think they're ready for this, and they just decide, you know what, I'm not ready for this for whatever reason. The 101 clients, that means that the recovery specialist actually met met with them and did some work with them. Some of these folks, the whole idea is we're trying to actually get them clean so they can get the injection. So we're providing support even though they haven't gotten to the injection point yet. Because in order to get clean, again, extremely difficult for a lot of these people. So,
question. Mm-hmm. When they come directly from the Kenosha County Detention Center, is that on one of the jail vans that drops them off right at your door, or do they get private transport?
We actually go pick them up.
Okay.
We pick them up from the jail, and then the first thing that we do is bring them to the health department to get their injection. So,
okay.
So, yeah. Okay. 80 clients were actually provided services by health, and you know, Amanda kind of talked about the services. The one thing I want to mention is it isn't simply an injection, because all this, the health screening they do, and the nurses are amazing at working with these folks and understanding kind of the issues, and even though they're not therapists, they play therapists a lot when you're in that injection appointment. So we've done 70 of those multidimensional assessments I mentioned. Our therapist does a great job with that, because what we also need in order to bill insurance is a diagnosis. So through his assessment, he's able to generate a diagnosis and again give us a sense of the big picture and what brought this person to us. So 58 clients actually received the injection through February 28th of 17, you'll see. And right now we have 15 people on the waiting list, although the two more I got today make it 17 before I walked in the door.
So does that mean they're still in jail and they're to be released or what?
Actually, to my knowledge, because it doesn't always come on the referral, I usually have to call back and ask, none of them are in jail. They're just out in the community right now dealing with their addiction. One of the things that's tough about a waiting list is that these people are ready at this point, and if we have to wait a month or 6 weeks, we sometimes lose people in the sense that they just will call them, they won't call us back, or they're just in a tough situation. So that's the difficult part.
A lot of guys quit drinking when the bar closes.
Right.
So you're waiting for some of these people to get actually do 7 to 10 days to get dry, and
we're waiting for that, but then we're also full. So our recovery specialists work with about 18 to 20 people at a time, which is a pretty significant number. And so we really, one of the things is I have to make a determination about when we have too many people in the program, because I can tell you that if they don't have that support through the recovery specialist and the therapist, they struggle. They can get injections elsewhere. They can get treatment elsewhere. But these people, because they have such high need, they need the support. And if we just take everybody, and the recovery specialist work with 30 people, as you can imagine, there's no way you can see 30 people 4 or 5 times a week. It's just impossible. So part of it is we really kind of have to make sure we're focused on the recovery of those people that we have in the program. So,
you're seeing them weekly to start off with?
Well, the therapist is actually seeing them weekly to start, sometimes twice a week, depends on the level of need. The recovery specialist to start is seeing them 4 or 5 times a week. So, it's very intensive. I have yet to find a program that's as intensive as this. Program demographics, just to give you a sense, we have 42 males in the program. When I say in the program, out of the 58 people who've gotten injections, we have 42 male, 16 female. You can see the race ethnicity breakdown. The average age of our participants is 38 years old. I think people sometimes have this perspective that that these are people who are younger, who are shooting up heroin, but the reality is 75% of our people started on prescription opiates. So they're using things like Oxycontin. We have an example of someone who's been in the program who had a knee injury in college. This is someone who went on a college scholarship, busted his knee up, doctor put him on, and I don't remember if it was Oxycontin, but put him on a prescription opiate. That's what started his addiction. So again, someone who is very successful, prior to the program, but 75% of these folks start with those prescription opiates. And I obviously know, you know, the state legislature is doing some things and has done some things to try to curb, you know, opiate use and misuse in terms of reporting and things like that. So the addiction history for these folks is 10 years in terms of opiates. So they've been using that substance for a decade on average. So pretty significant. And 20 years of alcohol use. So again, you know, a couple of decades. So these, again, these are high need, high risk folks. And I think I mentioned earlier, 75% of the participants have a mental health history or diagnosis.
I got a question. Mm-hmm. I look at the race, Caucasians 52, Hispanics 5, right. African Americans 1. We're not reaching that community? Or?
You know what? One of the things that I looked at was kind of where we're getting our referrals from. And because we take referrals from every direction you can possibly imagine, part of this is going back to the referral sources and saying, hey, you know, what's happening here? And I actually reached out to the Living Free coordinator at the detention center because that's where we get, you know, really most of our referrals, because I want to kind of pick her brain, because the Living Free program is an alcohol and drug-based program while they're in jail. So, you know, I want to find out from her, you know, are we reaching, you know, everyone? And is there a way to reach more minority folks? Because you're right, that's not happening right now.
So based off of reading the data, it is not a safe assessment to say that it's a problem relatively isolated to middle-aged white males?
It's a problem across the board. There's no doubt. If you look at the data on heroin use and opiate use, absolutely. All age ranges, all races, ethnicities, it's significant.
I just can't believe they've been using this stuff for 10 years, though.
They're still standing. It's crazy.
Yeah. You know, many of them, before their addiction, they were very functional. They had jobs, and even during the early onset of their addiction, they were able to maintain their employment for a number of years. But then what you start to see is, you know, they're fired from one job, they get another job, they don't stay very long, and so you kind of see that they're recycled through the workforce, because eventually that addiction catches up with them in terms of employment.
Do you see a difference between, you know, in efficacy with the withdrawal with somebody who's been an addict for 10 years versus somebody who's been addicted versus or 2 years? You know, like, is a person who's been addicted for 10 years, are they harder to treat, or is it all the same?
You know, and Amanda, you might be able to speak to this too, but I haven't noticed a difference. It still comes down to someone's level of commitment, mm-hmm. you know. And sometimes with the people who haven't been addicted as long, you know, people talk about rock bottom, and you know, there's arguments about whether you have to hit rock bottom. But sometimes with those people who may have been addicted less, you know, like 2, 3, 4 years, their level of commitment isn't quite the same, because they still have people around them who they still have some level of support, so they haven't maybe lost as much.
I have a question. You mentioned, you gave the example, there's an athlete that had a blew out his knee or whatever. Why are we seeing him? Here's my point. Mm-hmm. This doctor, he goes to a doctor, he must have health insurance, I'm mm-hmm. guessing. Mm-hmm. Doctor puts him on an opioid, and suddenly he's our problem or your problem. Why isn't that the doctor's problem? Mm-hmm. I mean, what I'm saying is, he goes, listen, doc, you put me on a drug that's making me addicted to, I got a whole lot of problems. Why, what does the doctor say? I don't want to see you. I mean, I don't understand that part unnecessarily. And that's the part I've always had problems with this is, aren't the doctors responsible for putting these people on these? They're giving us some strong opioids. They know this. What do they tell them? Just, I don't want to see you again. Go, if you know, here's an extremely addictive drug. You need it for your pain, but don't ever come back here again. If you're sitting here, go to the county or go to somewhere else. I mean, where's their responsibility in this whole thing? I mean, they're the ones prescribing this stuff, right? I mean,
yeah. Gwen, I don't know if you have a thought on that.
No, I just wanted to say you're thinking of one provider, right. But many of these individuals, because of their addiction, they have multiple providers, and because up until now there was no network to determine who all is giving him the prescription. then he can have multiple prescriptions at the same time.
But they still have to be scripted by a doctor.
Yes, but...
So that doctor should... Where's the responsibility on this?
Yes.
I don't care. There's no response.
One doctor doesn't know that he's going to another, so he or she thinks that they're giving that person a legitimate prescription for pain.
There's a doctor's name on an opiate that is very addictive, okay? and no one ever confronts the physicians on this at all? In any of these, all that we've been exposed to about this opiate problem, where are the doctors that prescribe this stuff to these people? Or to any patient.
Well, I think what most doctors will do if they find out somebody's, you know, shopping around and hopping from one to another, they'll cut that person off.
But
they don't know that until we get into...
I'm extremely surprised the lawyers haven't gotten into that. We're the lawyers in this. They want to sue a doctor and malpractice for anything. Have we ever seen one case of someone going to a doctor and says, I'm suing you because you prescribed opiates to this person, he's all messed up, you're responsible? We've never seen...
Not in the ones we're working with.
No. Well, and I think with the state legislation, they're amped up to have providers monitor the prescription drug monitoring program, which is the PDMP. It's a state program. Providers are mandated to check that prior to prescribing an opioid patient.
I can remember.
And that's new. That's new.
Go ahead.
But in the CDC or the Center of Disease Control has come out with new prescribing requirements for providers. So rather than prescribing somebody who came in with,
I'm in the health insurance business, and I can name the number of cases I've been involved in where physicians have been sued for malpractice claims and for doing too many surgeries, not enough surgeries. I mean, it's amazing. And that's not a good thing necessarily, but they're being held liable for this. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, there's this void about having the physicians. I just kind of an observation on this.
I hear your outrage. I think a lot of times, it starts, as we've said, with a legitimate complaint. They find themselves addicted. The doctor realizes they keep asking for more. And a common practice is just to say, too bad, how sad. And now they're left on the street, which is where they come up with the heroin addiction. A lawyer is not going to take somebody on who has no money.
No, he's going to take on the physicians. They've got all the money, the networks.
Right.
I mean, I'm very surprised this hasn't happened, considering what I've seen in my life, what doctors have been sued on a lot less than this, significantly less.
I still want to say it's just not one physician. It's multiple providers in different systems that they would have to go after at the same time, and that's where the difficulty comes.
Well, my question is, you got to go to a drugstore. If they're getting a prescription. I mean, I go to CVS, it doesn't matter what CVS in the country I go to, they know it's me. If a guy's showing up at a drugstore, you know, Mike Gable, he's getting a drug from Dr. Sam today and Dr. Jones tomorrow, and, you know, isn't this gonna ring a bell?
If you go to the same drugstore, same chain.
Well.
Sure, certainly.
Well, and this is, as Amanda has referred to, and I think Chris, the whole PDMP is trying to network the physicians and the pharmacies so that I write a script, and before it gets filled, you know, before I write it, I need to see, has this guy been to the ER? Has he been to somebody else? Has he been to a different specialist? But it's slow on the uptake, and it requires more effort. You're absolutely right. We have to be accountable.
Yeah. That's just an observation, because seems like in all this discussion we've had since I've been here, and stuff you see from the state, the federal, I'm not seeing one word about anyone saying, you know, where are the doctors in this? Where is the people that are actually scripting these opiates?
Starting the problem.
Yeah. But even if they prescribe them and all of a sudden they stop, now you can find it on the street in higher volumes and less expensive, and it doesn't hit your insurance, and that's the problem now.
Yeah.
The access to it on the street is greater than it is by prescription. And some of that we don't even know what is mixed all in it.
Well, and heroin's even cheaper than prescription drugs.
Exactly.
So
it is.
Mm-hmm. There's the lure there.
Yeah, but I had not seen.
I wonder if we could, go ahead.
This came up actually on Capitol Hill as we were doing our lobbying work in various Congress members' offices. Kenosha, Racine, Milwaukee, and Allegheny County. And that question did come up in one of the workshops on the opioid crisis. I guess there was a woman who was a nurse who said in the 80s, we started with 2 Tylenol and slowly ratcheted up from there. And so there was some question from that session as we went in to do our lobbying work as to whether or not there was some sort of legislative standard in terms of pain being like the fifth standard. It was kind of a revelation to me in Baldwin's office to find out from her staffer that apparently no, there is no fifth legislative standard with regards to pain. However, the VA did have that in their policy and procedure manuals, which caught my ears because then the question became, well, the VA is responsible for training something like 40 to 60% of the nation's healthcare workforce. Has that had some sort of inadvertent effect? And of course I was told, you know, no. But no, that question did come up. Is there something that could be done at the federal level to at least grab the attention of the AMA and Big Pharma? Because this really is their problem, essentially. Nobody was really quite sure what it would take to do that or how, but everybody did think it was at least be a good idea to try that. So I hear you. I mean, it's something that's
well, no, I'm just curious. Yeah. Okay.
Not an answer, but at least, you know, folks are thinking at a level where they could probably grab the attention of folks like you're looking to do.
Leah?
Yeah, I have a question. So you said Medicaid covers this for these patients. Is there any concern with the changes with the Affordable Care Act that are happening now that this, you know, about this program since, you know, they rely on Medicaid money? It seems like Medicaid is, you know, a target of this, you know, the new administration. There's a concern there that this funding.
I mean, there is a concern. I guess, you know, until we know for sure exactly what's going to happen, you know, if Medicaid's coming in block grant form, that certainly could have an effect. Yeah, you know, I guess we just kind of have to wait and see. Mm-hmm. You know,
there was a commitment yesterday from the legislators who attended the disability rights budget presentation, and included Van Wongard and Barca and Birch were there.
Todd.
Pretty much just, yeah, and Todd, to say that, you know, Wisconsin has a very inclusive Medicaid program and we don't want to necessarily, and Medicare, and don't want to necessarily take things away, but it's a wait and see. It really is. And we'll keep you updated on that as we hear things.
Walker's budget actually dealt with for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
How expensive is a shot?
What's the going rate these days, Glenn?
About $1,300 a shot.
You can buy a lot of heroin on the street.
It was mentioned in D.C. among all the offices of the Wisconsin delegation that, you know, not only us that make use of Vivitrol, but I think Milwaukee and another county, and that it is Medicaid that supports that. We'd like to continue that. It seems that folks were very understanding of that, particularly because now we have in the northern and western portions of the state, as we begin to grapple with this, now meth is apparently making a comeback, as I learned in a number of offices. So,
where can you get this drug from? I mean, who can inject
Vivitrol?
It?
The Vivitrol?
Mm-hmm.
By provider? It's a prescription? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, so a doctor your family doctor or a practitioner could actually prescribe it if he or she was, nurse practitioner.
Okay, so my question is, out of these people that you've seen, they're all Medicaid?
No.
Like half?
More than that,
I'd say.
Okay, and I guess I'm trying to wrestle with this again. Medicaid covers the drug. Why can't they go to a doctor and get this?
They wouldn't get the amount of services that we're providing, and I'm not sure what doctors in our area are comfortable even prescribing it, because you should have some sort of addiction background and understanding the impact that the drug has and the person's coming in and all the lab work you got to do before you even drop it.
So you're talking about an MD that can prescribe the opiate but has no clue about this or wouldn't do it?
They might. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's more specialized, I think, than just saying I have the ability to prescribe a medication. So you come into my office, I give you the shot. Well, I better have done all the tests to make sure you were clean for 7 to 10 days, And it's not, this is only the small part of treatment. This is the medically assisted treatment, so the Vivitrol gets rid of the cravings, but you better be knee deep into seeing someone on the side in group or individuals in order to help you with the other addiction.
I understand. So, I understand that part of it.
If you have those connections and support, then certainly if there's a somebody else out in the community.
And there are people too that, you know.
But there isn't here, is there? I mean, in our community, I'm not aware of anybody.
There, I get calls for referrals for people who have a lot of support, you know, so they have supportive family, friends, that kind of thing. And those are folks that we don't take into the program. I give them other options, and we see they can get an injection, they can go to, you know, they can go to individual treatment on a weekly basis. But for the people that, most of the people who are referred to this program, that won't be effective. Their addiction history is 10 years. An injection. And I want to be, and you know, Amanda mentioned the word magic. Vivitrol isn't magic. It's very helpful. But if there's not supportive treatment and services with it, the likelihood, particularly of long-term success, is slim. So
how many shots do you give them over how many months?
You know,
shot slide.
Yeah, I've actually got the shot slide. so you can kind of see.
I do remember that.
I think you're asking in terms of, we ask people to give us at least a 6-month commitment to the program. But what we're finding is most people probably need, and Amanda can probably speak to this too, probably need more, in the line of 8 or 9 months in terms of getting the injection and receiving the services.
Well, when I talked to the district attorney a while back, he said that it usually takes 11 months for the craving to go away in the brain.
Right, and so we've looked at that individually. There's not a magic number per se. Like, okay, it's 12 months for everybody or 11 months. For some folks it is. We've actually, on the slide, we've got two people, one who's at 11, one who's at 12 months, because for them, if you look at actually the cravings of those two people, they don't have any cravings. They're reporting zero cravings. For them, it was more of a preventative measure. They're not quite confident yet. So the craving data that we've seen actually shows significant reductions, particularly as you get past the third injection. So that's when I talked about those 90 days. If you can get people past that 90 days to injection number 4, the data is pretty amazing when you look at the cravings. So
if we get somebody, we've taken care of them for 12 months, and then we find out they're back on heroin, are we going to take them back again?
You know, for me, it would depend upon their situation. I wouldn't rule it out, but I'd want to look at where they're at. And for us, one of the things that we do is, are they engaged in treatment? Because again, they can get the injection in a lot of places, and if they're not engaged in treatment, then there's people we've terminated from the program, discharged. Because listen, you're not. So for me, it would depend upon is that person going to engage in treatment again, or are they just coming back in for an injection? Because that's not what this program is about, just the injection. So
I'm new to the program, but some of the things I've seen in the 6 weeks I've been part of it, people have to undergo dental procedures. They're really, really cautious. And they're telling their providers, I don't want to be on any narcotics. They're very committed.
The other thing we have too, and I didn't put in the slide, is for these people who are ready for getting ready for discharge, and even really before that, if they qualify, we're looking at our comprehensive community services program, so they can kind of transition in other services. So it's not as though at month 12, someone's just gone and they'll never see anyone again. So there's other supportive services that we can kind of try to put in place to kind of, I guess, ease them away from the service that we provide. So
they have to find something else to, mm-hmm. And you kind of guide them toward that?
Absolutely. We got, and you know what, it one of the things that I say to the recovery specialists and the therapists, and they're well aware of this, if they don't have anybody after 11 months, we haven't done our job. They need other support. So it's really kind of building that. And success builds on success with these people. It is amazing to see some of these people now, versus when we saw them the first time. These people were at their lowest point in their lives when we've seen them. And now we've got people who are smiling, walking around, participating in group, love coming to the health department to see the nurses. We've got one participant who him and his mother want to start, you know, they want to start doing some fundraising for this population of people. We have another participant who's starting at Gateway to do her actually alcohol and drug certification. She wants to be a counselor. So seeing all these things on such a consistent basis, you know, for me really kind of shows what the program means to these people. You know, and you know, people have I've heard people refer to it as saving lives, which is absolutely true. But we're also helping to give people their lives back because again, a lot of these people were successful before.
I'm still amazed at this. I'm still having a hard time with this. We're saving people from their doctors. A question, do you have any statistics just from the stuff you read about how many people have been prescribed opiates that have to go to something like this? Do you have, is it 1 out of 10? Two out of five? Or you don't know that?
I don't know. I do know, again, that 75% of people start on an opiate-based medication. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it was prescribed by the doctor, because for a while there, people were getting, you know, they were getting medication from somebody's, you know, cabinet. Someone was selling that medication. But I don't know. I don't know if Gwen knows if you've ever run across anything like that. I haven't.
No, this is part of a bigger program. I mean, even in Kenosha, we're doing medication collection. Yeah. You know, the health department is part in trying to engage the whole community in this effort. What you're speaking on is the problem we have with Big Pharma, which you've mentioned already. The drugs are available. So how do we convince a group of people that have addictive behavior not to use the drugs? And that's where this treatment program is really unique, in that individuals really have no cravings whatsoever. It's a small pilot, and it is done in about 3 other counties here in Wisconsin. But I think this will be helpful, but there are other terms to this that we have to make sure works.
I know they gave me an oxycodone when I helped. I took it one day and said, this sucks. Well, three of my friends says, well, what are you doing with it?
Right.
I'm throwing it away.
Right.
I mean, I was surprised how many people use this, and, you know, they're probably addicted, but that's a controlled addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, the people in our program, you know, many of them obviously started on those opiate-based medications, but, you know, they've done exactly what you said, Mike. They said, what are you doing with that? Let me get that. And then it started to steal, you know, stealing medication. Then it was, you know, you pay for it on the street, because for a while it was pretty, you know, pretty prevalent on the street. You could get it. Now, as Gwen mentioned, it's more difficult, so people actually move to heroin because it's considerably cheaper. So.
And I want to say that individuals that are prescribed opiates for bone pain, if you can imagine, that's one of the worst pains you can have in your body, and you've got these athletes that are otherwise healthy that have an injury, and they're taking this medicine for about 3 months. Once they start to cut back, the symptoms of withdrawal are so severe, we call it junk sick, where they really don't want to experience that, so now they want to get back to that level that they're not feeling sick anymore.
Right.
So we're even working with that.
I understand that. I'm just having a hard time with this, where a physician, you use that example, I'm that person's physician, I'm just going to prescribe it and let him go. I'm not going to, maybe I would introduce him to you or say, by the way, I'm about to prescribe to you something that's extremely addictive, and you could be a mess. Here's the statistics. Here's an organization I want you to call them, get in contact with. You know, it just seems that we need to have some people helping out in this problem. And it you guys do outstanding work, and us in the county are all in. It just seems like we're the people are causing this problem, and that's the physicians and the hospital and the networks. And they're the ones with the experience. They should be the ones that should be held responsible for this, because they're the ones that know it the most. They're the caretakers. They're the ones that know this stuff. They've been trained. I'm very surprised that no one's ever attempted to go after them on this, from a legal standpoint.
In this community, we will bring the providers together in our in one of our outreach grants that we have, and have them have that conversation with each other. How do they help to alleviate this problem? And this will be coming even this year.
I'd like to also bring their their liability, their you know, all of their insurance people that would say, how do you guys not worry about this? From a, you know, malpractice insurance standpoint, you know.
You don't do the right thing, they'll sue you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand that. How often does a doctor
I know the people in the malpractice business, they're in there all the time. Not on this so much, but like, you know, here's all the things that people you can get sued on. You know, people get sued on, you wouldn't believe it. Now it's changed, but.
Well, like I said, how often, I mean, I don't know, I'll ask my doctor next time I see him. How often will they renew a prescription for an opioid? I mean, it's not like, you know, I look at my mother's and, you know, three prescriptions. You know, I'm an opioid, what, lifetime? I mean, there has to be a limit.
Right. And I think for most doctors that's the case, but I mean, Gwen and
some of the guidelines are changing now where they offer the first 3 to 5 days from major surgery, and then they go to non-aspirin type Tylenol, Advil. So I would say the maximum is 15. I think they're trying to take it down to eight pills. So they're really trying to limit it. They're working really hard to try to get this done. But it just takes time.
I'm sorry, that's my fault. I'm the one that I kept you here.
I've got a 15-minute window according to the policy.
So you said that, and I forgot.
I've got 5 minutes, and then I've got to go.
I'm getting into malpractice stuff.
So, you know, I mentioned some of those, I guess, feel-good stories, but here's kind of the reality of where some of this is in terms of kind of outcomes. There are 6 people who aren't measured in here because they haven't been really in the program long enough. We really look at well past that kind of first injection and going into that second injection before we kind of look at the outcomes. So 94% of these people report significant craving reduction, so at least 50%. I can tell you I looked at a person who's on injection number 4. Injection 1, he reported 25 out of 100. We use a scale of 0 to 100. He is now at a 0. That is not unusual. I just looked at his craving data today. That is not unusual. Most people report even more significant reductions than 50%. So almost everyone, their cravings are considerably lower. Again, that calms down the brain. It helps us start to focus on those coping mechanisms and kind of help, you know, helps them get their life back on track. So that blew my mind because I thought, okay, maybe initially I had read all the data on Vivitron. I thought, okay, well, I want to see what it does. This is quite frankly better than even what I expected. So.
Well, we'll let you go. You got students sitting around. You know what they do. Paper airplanes and spitballs. You know, and John, bring them back any time.
Well, I mean, is there anything else you want to hit on the outcomes before you?
Yeah, you can just look at 90% of these people have stable or they get stable housing. 83% were employed or were employed at discharge. Again, a lot of these people had skills before when they were clean. They had jobs, they did all right. Mm-hmm. So it's like if we can help them get clean and stay clean, they can maintain employment. 50 out of the 52, so 96% haven't recidivated, they haven't come back into the system. We don't have long-term data yet, we'll see what that looks like a year down the road. So we've got to take a look at that. But many of these people had multiple convictions and within a matter of a year. So these are people who are kind of in and out of the jails. And I think I mentioned earlier, less than 5% of the drug screens that were performed by health and, of course, professional services group post-initial injection, so after that initial injection, were positive for alcohol or opiates. Again, there are some other substances sometimes that they will come up positive for. But the program is definitely working for a lot of these folks. So.
Real good, thank you. Yeah. Feel free to come back and educate us anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
At some point in time, we'd like to bring some program participants and have them kind of discuss their involvement and what they experience in the program.
I think, like I said, I'd be extremely curious if you could convince some doctors to come in here.
You get some doctors.
And get their opinion on this. I'd like to give them a third degree. I would.
All right, I have an idea. We should collaborate on something.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, boy.
You'll like it.
I love an inquisition. Any other business that is authorized by law? Member comments? Committee members, any comments?
Nope.
Motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second? All in favor?
All right.
We're out of here.
When kids can say...